This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Welcome to The Politics Guys, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Trey Orndorff, a political scientist at Oklahoma Christian University, and I'm joined by a professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University, Michael Baranowski. Mike, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Trey.
Yeah, we don't always get to do the shows together, so it's fun to have the two of us take this on. We got a lot of things going on. I mean, we're going to be chatting this week about DeSantis and Twitter Spaces, and I think that's going to take some time, both in content and in form. We're going to talk about Tim Scott announcement earlier in the week, a little bit tame by comparison. We're going to talk a little bit about the lack of a debt ceiling agreement, something we've been kind of keeping our eyes on all this week. We're going to talk about a couple of Supreme Court rulings, and then we're going to finish up the show chatting about some things happening in Ukraine. But before we get into all of that, Mike, you know, the show actually has some cool news that we want to announce, and I'm going to let you take over for that.
Yeah, we do. First off, I want to thank everyone who offered up suggestions for our first ever supporter chosen and real-time supporter participation segment. And we have picked a topic based on your votes, your input, and that's going to be tipping points into civil conflict. So we're going to look at that, the conditions under which partisanship might turn into active conflict and what sort of things might be helpful in preventing that, or and even people who think that it maybe shouldn't be prevented, where we're at right now in the U.S., and also what we think the likelihood of things getting even worse than they've been for the past 7 years might be in the near-term future. So there's a lot there. It's probably going to be a mega segment. I think it should be an interesting topic. And Jay and I will be recording this segment 9 a.m. on Saturday, June 3rd. So if you are a supporter at the $10 or higher level, we'll be sending you a Zoom link so you can listen in on that segment as well as make comments in like the comments box there that we will respond to in real time as we're recording. And if you're not able to be there, now that you know the topic, if you have some questions about that, you can just send them to us now through the Discord or mail at politicsguys.com. And we will also try to get those included in our conversation. And so we're going to be doing at least one of these. Go ahead, Trey.
So that's June the 3rd at 9 a.m. Eastern time for the show, right?
Yes.
Okay, that's
right.
A week from Saturday.
Yeah,
as somebody who
not
lives in Central.
Time, yes, good point. Yeah, the good point. Yes, Eastern time. That's right. I tend to think of it as the only time, but that's just my Eastern time bias. So, yeah. And I should also mention, we're going to be doing at least one of these every month, possibly more, depending on how things go. I hope it's going to be more. And, you know, if that sounds like something you'd like to be part of, you can be a supporter again at the $10 a month per higher level, be included in that. And to do that, I'll go to patreon.com/politicsguys. And we always have that link, of course, as well as our other support options in the show notes. So there we go. That's the news from the show.
Well, I'm really excited about that. Maybe I'll have to like pop in and ask you questions or I don't know, moderate, but
that would be awesome.
Yeah, that could be a lot of fun. So,
Ray from Oklahoma has this really.
I should make a pseudonym. I could be like Cowboy or I. Well, that's a lot of fun. And I am kind of excited. I've always been excited about the opportunity, maybe for people to do things a little bit more live. But, you know, maybe on that front, you know, that kind of kicks us into our first story a little bit. I thought we might start with this week, Mike, is going to be DeSantis, right? DeSantis formally entered the Republican primary on Wednesday using something called Twitter Spaces. Now, for those not in the know, Twitter Spaces was actually launched back in May 2021 to compete with another service called Clubhouse. Again, it depends on what you do. You may or may not have ever heard of these. But what it was a way to kind of share live audio and kind of have an interactive radio station, if you will. And for those with even deeper memories, you might remember that back in the day, Twitter actually had something called Periscope. Do you remember Periscope, Mike?
Yeah, I do, actually.
Yeah, the live video sharing. Well, you know, that actually ended up getting shut down, but they used the tools from it to create what we now think of as being Twitter Spaces, which is weird. So DeSantis decides to do this. Now, I think there's probably some posturing going on here with Elon Musk and this service, and I think we want to talk about that a little bit on its own. But obviously, for anybody who paid attention, did you try to log into it? I just wanted to start there. Did you try to log in and do all of that?
I totally did not. And apparently, I was joined by almost everyone who didn't try to log in, from what I understand.
Yeah, so I tried to log in. It didn't work so well for me live. And then after the fact, trying to get a hold of the recording, it is possible, by the way, if anybody needs it, you can let me know. I have the way to get there. But it isn't. It's almost like they scrubbed it from the internet, right? Elon Musk deleted a bunch of his tweets for how to get into it. The DeSantis campaign scrubbed all their links to it. So you've actually got to dig pretty hard to get a hold of that. So we can talk about this. But in terms of the rollout itself, I think the best I can kind of say was trying to listen to it, dealing with it after the fact. Mike, maybe you'll agree with this. It was worse than a spring pandemic general education classroom is kind of what I felt.
Ooh,
about.
That's not good. Yeah, that's not good. Oh, no.
Yeah.
That spin about how they broke the internet. It's like, no, this is what happens when you fire like more than half of your employees after you take over a company. Gee, things don't work. What a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I felt when we tried to do online classrooms, right? Like, wait, you're saying there's not enough faculty to do all of this? Okay, anyway, we shouldn't talk too much of that. That was a fun time, he said with air quotes. Now, what's been interesting this week, of course, is that the other campaigns have been poking a bunch of fun at this. I don't know if you saw all of this, but Biden, Trump, and others have been like linking all of their things with either hashtags or quotation marks, "the link works," which is phenomenal advertising. So what eventually ends up happening is, so Elon Musk, the guy who owns it, he can't get the link to work. So he logs in with David Sacks' account and they start a new Twitter space on David Sacks' account. And just as you note, you know, to say like, well, we broke the internet. I've just got too many followers to make this work and somehow made that go. Now, again, this takes a lot of time. Now, it's weird to me, though. You know, they keep talking about they broke the internet. They're trying new things. As Elon Musk put it, quote, "It's your first time to hear live from a candidate, not just canned speeches. You can tell from our mistakes that this is real," end quote. Which is a bizarre way of putting that out. But that actually seemed, Mike, and I thought we might start here, that seems to be a real mark of the campaign, and it seemed to be a real touchstone in their conversations again and again, whether they were bringing Massey or other individuals into the Twitter space with them to kind of ask these quote-unquote questions. But it was all about how part of what DeSantis is about is fighting against the media itself. If you look over at the Washington Examiner, which is really a right of center sheet, they pointed out that while the whole thing was a bit of a disaster, that it points to something larger and really important. In the Examiner's words, it's, quote, "But we should mark the moment as the first real effort of major politicians to tear down traditional media. The technical failures and uncompelling opening might be enough to dissuade other candidates from taking comparable risks. But on the other hand, it seems inevitable that the current television news edifice sits on a crumbling foundation," end quote. So I found that really bizarre, and I find a lot of those comments a little bit bizarre as somebody who actually studies this and actually wrote a book about it. But what do you think about putting so much of the emphasis in coming out on the "I'm fighting the media"? Because that seemed to be, for me, probably 60% of what his pitch to the American public was in this Twitter space.
Yeah, I feel like Ron DeSantis is just a a sad, thirsty little man who is desperately trying to be the competent Trump, and he's sort of hitting all the right notes, but he just, I don't think he can really do it all that well. He's like I said, he's sort of almost a pathetic little creature, I guess. I guess all politicians are to a certain extent, or most of them, desperate, sad little men and women. But boy, little Ronnie DeSanctimonious seems to be, I would say, worse than a lot. Maybe not quite at Ted Cruz levels, but wow, I don't see much of a future for him in presidential politics. That's for sure.
Did you just quote Donald Trump? I just want to throw that
out
there.
I sure did. Yeah.
So, I mean, one of the things that has kind of been your take on this every time we're talking about the presidential election is, I don't want to mean this in the sense that you want Trump to win, but you kind of see Trump as being, inevitable.
I would say inevitable would be slightly too strong, but I think it's telling that the more the public knows about Ron DeSantis, the lower his ratings go. I mean, that's not how it's supposed to work, typically. And I don't see that changing anytime soon. It seems to me that Donald Trump is incredibly effective at eviscerating his opponents. And I do not think that Ron DeSantis is a particularly worthy opponent for Donald Trump. He's a lightweight, I think, in terms of the sort of debate that has come to characterize the Republican contest, for better or for worse. And so I just don't see Ron DeSantis having any sort of I know what he's going for, right? Trump without the drama. But I think what people are going to be hearing is Trump light. And there's just not going to be, outside of a very small base, there's not going to be that much compelling support for Ron DeSantis. I mean, the donor class wanted to make it a thing. And I think a lot of these sort of Republican elite types wanted to make it a thing, and they tried to build him up. But I think he's sort of a Potemkin village here.
So there's just kind of no hope. So, I mean, in that sense, do you see the kind of the Twitter rollout as just being maybe emblematic then of the larger failing? In other words, I'm going to do what Trump does, but not as effectively.
Yeah. And, also it doesn't hurt to say, well, I'm going to make friends with the richest man in the world. I mean, if you're a presidential candidate, it seems like a reasonable move. He's trying anything to be different, to stand out. And it just, like, to me, like I said, it just seems so desperately thirsty. And I think people can get a sense of that. I think Trump comes by his sort of shtick legitimately, but on DeSantis, it feels kind of fake to me. And I think voters are good at picking that out, which is why I don't think he has much of a chance, because it's weird on paper. I mean, DeSantis, I would argue, has a much more compelling biography than Donald Trump. DeSantis wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth, right? His mom was a nurse. His dad installed those Nielsen boxes and TV, for ratings. And so, I mean, he worked hard and went to, was it Yale and then Harvard? He's this great American success story. And yet he seems not to be really good with people, which oftentimes is a problem for politicians, doesn't connect and has made a lot of people not like him, and doesn't seem to have much charisma. And I could go on. I mean, at this point, the only advantage I think that he has is, okay, he's got $116 million in the bank, give or take, if you add in his campaign, his PAC, and the super PAC money. And that's more than Trump. And I know some people are focusing on that right now, but Donald Trump can raise a whole bunch of money very, very quickly. And so I'm not impressed with the DeSantis people saying, oh, we raised over $8 million in the first 24 hours, and that was more than Biden raised in his first day. It's like, I don't think that means much. They're whistling past the graveyard here. I think Ron DeSantis is not going to happen for him.
So let me ask a broader question here, because this is one that does, in fact, always direct my eyeballs. And that's this take on what's the way that candidates are going to interact, and what's the way that we're going to end up having technology interact with politics, right? That's my jam. And it was weird in some ways to listen to that be the point of this. Musk, obviously, I mean, he's promoting his own platform repeatedly in the early moments of this. But guest after guest who's coming on, they kept having this conversation about, you know, the First Amendment only works if there's places for critical thinking. And both Musk and DeSantis are jumping in to say, look, you know, that's why we have to have this. You know, Musk goes on to say, quote, deciding what the narrative is, there's only so much you can put in a newspaper, end quote. I mean, what
wait,
do you,
Trey, I hold on, I want to make sure I heard you, Ray. So is part of the argument that Twitter is a place for critical thinking?
Well, that's why you are getting right to where I was leading. That was precisely what the argument was.
Wanted to make sure that I heard that right. All right. Okay. That's
And to be clear, that's not my, I'm not arguing that. but that is in fact the argument. So I guess my question is, I mean, again, one of the things that gets pulled out here is the idea like, look, we wouldn't have understood all of the true things about COVID if it wasn't for Twitter. And even then, if it wasn't for, and I'm blanking on who, I wrote everybody else's name down. One of our other kind of thanked Elon, like, look, if it wouldn't have been for you buying the First Amendment, is kind of the way he put it, then, you know, we wouldn't then get to know all the truth behind the truth. Well, this kind of seems to be the new take for campaigns. So, I mean, you know, we're kind of having laughing about that a little bit, but what do you think about that? I mean, again, takes up a ton of the announcement time. Obviously, DeSantis not only thinks this is going to land, but, you know, he has a bunch of other congresspersons who are on board with this kind of idea. You know, again, we're laughing at it a little bit, but what about the argument that Twitter is the space where you're going to find out the things that you're not going to find out otherwise? What do you say about that?
Oh, I think Twitter's the space where you're going to find out the things that you were hoping to find out. You know, it's just, yeah, so I did. Yeah, no, it's the idea that people actually care about a free and fair exchange of ideas, at least people running for office. That's as bogus as the idea that businesses want robust competition. I mean, no, they want to do whatever it is that allows them to get into power and maintain power. And if that means walled off little communities where all their precious little snowflakes can congregate and pat each other on the back about how wonderful they are and how horrible the other side is, well, that's exactly what we'll get. So we're getting exactly the politics we deserve here with this.
So, I mean, taking on a technical point of view, I mean, you're kind of advocating here that this is the echo chamber effect, right? That you're going to follow the voices you want to follow. You're going to hear the things you want to hear. But is that any better than the old model? Or do you, what do you think about that? Again, just the argument coming from that point of view.
Oh, I think it's worse. I can't think of a period in my life where the quality of political debate hasn't gotten worse. It's pretty atrocious, and it's just going to get worse. Which is why I sometimes on my more depressive days, I have very little hope for the long term future of democracy in America, because I think it's dependent on a well informed electorate, and I think you know, Elon Musk is doing his part to destroy that, and as sort of a side project, right? So and there you go.
Well, so you know, one of the things I've often thought about this is, and I'm curious about we have either kind of these two extremes. We have the limited characters of Twitter. We have the few seconds of TikTok. We have these really small micro interactions, which don't really lead to larger conversations. We've talked about this on Discord with our supporters before, Ken, where I can't remember right now the specific argument you were having, but about, well, you know, what was the meaning behind the tweet? And the answer is, well, it's so short. How do we really know? There are these moments for barbs. And so we kind of have that. And then we have these moments like this Twitter space where I can't help but call it kind of the extra long form. That's really only designed for individuals who are already interested, right? You know, it's the multi-hour go. I mean, it kind of feels like we've lost the middle ground in communication where we can have that kind of mid-length. There's an amount of context to either that conversation or to that writing without it, but short enough, though, that you could legitimately assume that individuals who disagree with you would be willing to go along for that ride. And so it doesn't feel like in the modern space, I actually feel is the wrong word, as you research it, it doesn't appear that that middle space really exists anywhere except for some weird alcoves, maybe like us.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's why I think that Donald Trump is a perfect politician for our time. Right. I mean, he caught on to that and rode that wave to the White House. And I think there's a better than even odds that he will ride it back to the White House, because people love that. That's the culture. And no one's better at it in national politics than Donald Trump. And so I think that if I were a betting person, I'd say, I don't know, something like a Donald Trump is almost a shoe-in to win the Republican nomination. I don't care what he's convicted of. I think that just makes it, in a way, it almost helps him. Then I think I would say his odds are maybe 6 in 10 of winning the presidency.
Okay, so I'm just going to include one more little side note that I had listened to in this, and then we're going to move on to Tim Scott. But one of the highlights of, if you want to really understand what DeSantis was shooting for, the time when he's talking with Thomas Massie is probably one of the best moments to really get at it. And Massie starts it off with gushing at Elon. The gushing isn't what was surprising to me. So he goes on to say, like, look, I was the first member of Congress to own a Tesla. You know, I love all your things. You know, I invest in your stuff. And then he goes on to say,
oh, Elon, you're so lovely.
Yeah. Well, he actually goes on to say, the only thing I really disagree with is, since my house is off the grid, I can't use your battery. So I had to make my own from a Tesla that I got rid of because, you know, I don't like being on the grid, blah, blah, blah. And so finally, and I was never able to figure out which, there was too many people on the call at that moment. So even in the recording, you can't figure out who it is. But one of his colleagues is obviously trying to kind of come to his defense for a minute and go, yeah, but don't forget, Massie, you still are all pro coal. And you know, because he almost made himself kind of sound like a progressive in a way. You know, I'm on all electric and I'm off the grid. I mean, what do you think about those kinds of moments? For me, it kind of highlights what you were saying, which is, you know, you have such a targeted audience that they couldn't even take that without somebody going, oh, wait a second, I need to clarify this for Massie. You know, he's pro energy. What do you think about those kinds of weird little moments? You don't seem to get those in other contexts outside of like the Twitter space.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly agree that people feel much more of a license to be ignorant jackasses in Twitter space and in online forums than in real life, which is, I think, part of the problem with them. I mean, we've seen it to a limited extent, even in our own context, in our Facebook group, and every once in a while in the Discord, where people respond to each other in ways that I think most of them would still never do in real life. And so it doesn't surprise me at all. It's just more of the same. And I don't see any reason why that would get any better. So again, that's, I think, all really works for Donald Trump, who in that sense, even though he's an old man, he still is a man ahead of his age, ahead of his era, when it comes to just having an intuitive understanding of what works in this medium.
Well, let's move forward to talking about Tim Scott. So earlier in the week on Monday, Tim Scott, the only African-American Republican senator for the last decade, announced his bid for the presidency. Now, he was obviously a lot more traditional than DeSantis, but he also brought up, I mean, the centerpiece of his announcement, Mike, reminded me a lot of Condoleezza Rice. He said this, he said, quote, "When I cut your taxes, they call me a prop. When I refunded the police, they called me a token. When I pushed back on President Biden, they even called me the N-word. I disrupt their narrative. I threaten their control. The truth of my life disrupts their lives," Scott says. And so it really seems that what he's going to be running on is this idea that he's an African-American who doesn't fit the narrative. What do you think about Tim Scott's announcement?
Well, number of things. I mean, he's the only Black Republican senator. He's one of, I believe, 5 Black Republicans in Congress. And I think certainly that opens up a niche for him, right? You can point to him and say, "See, we have Black guys in our party too." They're not necessarily that visible, but now, but even race aside, Tim Scott is the sort of person who you might expect to have run for and successfully contested for the GOP nomination pre-Donald Trump. I mean, he's in his late 50s. He's been in the Senate for a decade. He's kind of an old-fashioned economic conservative in a lot of ways. One of his big issues, those opportunity zones, which is a conservative idea going back to the really 1970s and 1980s with Jack Kemp and then Paul Ryan in a later era. I think he's got the most compelling campaign biography. I believe his mom was a single mom, a nurse, I believe, who raised him, and he had to work really hard, not an Ivy League guy, and it's just this perfect story, really. And but again, I think if anything, Tim Scott is running for vice president here. I don't think he's a smart guy, obviously, and he knows that he has no real shot at the nomination, but I think he has a pretty good shot, depending on how he runs in the primaries, at being Donald Trump's VP.
You know, I wondered about that. I'm not as sure that he'd want to be Donald Trump's VP. So you really think that he would take that job?
I think a lot of good people would take that job because they're delusional in the sense, just like Mike Pence was, saying that, well, you know what, I can distance myself or kind of be the voice of reason. And also then, and it's always this great or good argument, well, not always, with so many of them, is, yeah, I'll have to suck it up there, but it will set me up. And because, my God, all the good I could do if I were in charge. And isn't it worth it to do that so I can do real good for the people of this country? And I think that's how a lot of them see it. And I wouldn't be surprised if Tim Scott was that person. I mean, you take a look at how Donald Trump greeted his entry into the campaign. He said on True Social, good luck, Senator Tim Scott. It's rapidly loading up with people. Tim's a big step up from Ron DeSanctimonious. I got opportunity zones done with Tim, a big deal that's been highly successful. Good luck, Tim. That sure sounds to me like someone who might be willing to consider you as a vice presidential nominee. And you put those two together, and even if Tim Scott can take maybe can add 1% of the black vote to Donald Trump's totals. Hey, that could be, in what's almost certainly going to be a close race, that could be a real difference maker. I don't think that there are other potential VP candidates who bring more of a potential advantage to a Trump whatever ticket than Tim Scott does. And I know VPs typically don't have coattails of any sort, but I think this could be just enough of kind of a VP coattail effect to make a difference in a close race. And I wouldn't be surprised if Tim Scott, who by presidential politics standards is not an elderly gentleman, is not really looking so much at 2024 as he is at 2028.
Now, I don't disagree about him looking to 2028. I'm not. And again, I don't disagree about Trump's potential intentions there, but let's look at the numbers for just a second, right? If you take a look at the polling data for the Republican primary right now, Trump is currently, as of today, sitting, again, it's going to change as time goes on, but right today, as of Friday, sitting on 54% of the primary vote. His closest opponent is DeSantis, who is at 20.7% of the vote. Scott isn't even hitting 2% currently, and Pence is in the most distant of third, even though he hasn't yet announced formally, at 5%. I can't help, you know, as you note, if you're Scott and you've seen what's gone down with Pence, I mean, maybe in a pre-Pence era, you know, Scott wants to go along with Trump. But okay, so Pence is sitting here. It certainly has not set him up to run again. And the thought that, barring death, that Donald Trump is somehow going to completely exit the oxygen of the Republican Party seems a little bit ridiculous to me. I'm just not sure. I would have to question anybody's sanity who thinks that they're going to be able to hitch on that pony to Trump
I think you're wrong. The reason why I disagree with you is that there's a huge difference between Donald Trump eligible to run for re-election and Donald Trump who can't run for re-election. And Donald Trump of 2028 would be someone who is not going to be in the race. We know that for an almost certain fact about as certain as we can get with these things. And so therefore, this isn't a Mike Pence situation. Tim Scott doesn't have to worry about certifying anything or anything like that. All he has to do is just kind of play nice, stay in the background, knowing that the Republican Party is Donald Trump's party for as long as he's alive and is able to talk, because this is the present and near-term future of the Republican Party, for better or for worse. And if he can ride that wave into the presidency in 2028, he'd maybe be foolish not to, as opposed to seeing who Trump ends up picking for his VP and having that person potentially be in the front-runner seat.
I mean, even if you go back, I mean, what's the last time we've had a VP win? I got to think about that.
George H.W. Bush, Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. I mean, that a couple of different eras ago almost.
but you have to also remember that, I mean, Al Gore won the popular vote and came within a hair's breadth of winning. So, and I think that those kind of looking back, that's not really useful in presidential politics. We have such a small end problem, given the fact that there's only one election every 4 years. I don't think it means that much. And also that I think politics, especially at the presidential presidential level, has changed so much that history is much less of a guide than it used to be. And so I'm not going to say I'm going to throw the history book out, but I think it's a lot less useful than it ever was. And which is why I think that Donald Trump, it's his Republican Party, I think, for as long as he's around and is able to go out and give speeches and raise grievances. And that's why but again, we're talking more about Donald Trump than Tim Scott. Like I say, one thing I like about Tim Scott, I mean, for a Republican, he's not bad. He's not about he's not a grievance guy, right? And I think that does give him potentially a lane. And DeSantis is trying to be sort of Trump without the Trumpiness. But, you know, in his announcement speech, right, Scott said, "Our party and nation are standing at a time for choosing victimhood or victory, grievance or greatness." I mean, he didn't mention Donald Trump's name, but you could hear the dog whistle there. Maybe the Trump people can't, but I sure could. And I think a lot of other people can hear that as well. And so if he can thread that needle, I don't think the nomination is realistically his in 2024. But if he can thread that needle, I think he's got a good shot of setting himself up for 2028, regardless of whether or not Trump actually is president in January 2025.
Yeah, and I mean, bringing Scott back for himself, you know, I liked a lot of the things he said. He reminded me in a lot of ways of Kasich.
Yeah, the only thing I'd say is the difference is he's much more conservative. I mean, you take a look at, I pulled up his rating on VoteView, which is the UCLA's, the political science folks do a like ideology ranking thing. Mm-hmm. In the 117th Congress, he was the 11th most conservative senator. He's gotten actually a little less conservative. He was the eighth most conservative in 116th, sixth most conservative in 115th. So, but he's still on the conservative end of the Republicans in the Senate. I mean, he's not kind of got, I don't know, emotional issues like, say, Donald Trump is. I know Jay's take on Donald Trump, right, is that, well, he's not, he's actually just more delusional than anything else. Well, that's a problem in your presidential candidate. But I don't think Tim Scott's delusional. I think he's a very conservative guy. I think another thing he might have going in his favor, at least on the Republican side, is I think he's the most realistically religious. Now, I mean, he has a sincere and deep-seated faith, I believe, that he's not just trying to fake like Donald Trump with the Bible that you're surprised it hasn't burst into his, you know, flames in his hands kind of thing. And I think that could appeal to a non-trivial portion of Republican primary voters. And I think he's probably intending to go into Iowa especially and really see if he can get some momentum with those voters and maybe move that into something. Because we should also point out that, by the way, the Republican primary rules are designed to favor front runners and weed out low vote total getters. And they were made even more so that way by Donald Trump after his first term, when, you know, he realized it would be in his to his favor to kind of cement his front runner status. And so that's another thing I would argue that's going in Trump's favor, or whoever can be kind of out the gate strong.
Yeah, I mean, Republicans reacted really strongly to the slugfest of Hillary and Obama forward and didn't want to have those same kinds of long-term, deep calendar fights. And you're right, in the wake of Trump, that was only solidified. But no, I mean, and that's true. Now, I mean, the other thing, I mean, that maybe this is more evidence for what you were saying, but that kind of religiosity is also something that's going to probably be a help in African-American communities. I think that's something sometimes it can be easy to forget. That is one of the more religious categories of contemporary Americans today. I was just taking a look at the state of religiosity in the United States. There's been a lot of changes recently, but one of the big locations for that is still African-Americans.
Yeah. I mean, and that was my point to why he would be such a great VP candidate. I mean, Donald Trump, the last two times, got something like 8% of the black vote. I mean, if you 1% more there in strategic locations, that could do a lot. That could make the difference. And so that's why I think he's a better VP than he is a president, at least in 2024. And I said he's a very smart guy, and I would expect he realizes that, too.
Well, why don't we just pause for just a moment and then come in and talk about something that didn't happen this week, a debt ceiling increase. So, Mike, one of the things that we had on the agenda for this week that we were just kind of waiting for, trying to see what we were going to get, to see what we could be able to talk about that, was there going to be in the outline for a debt ceiling agreement? Was there going to be an actual agreement? Was McCarthy going to send individuals home? And so as of the recording right now, McCarthy has sent the House home for Memorial Day weekend. And it seems like we aren't likely to get a deal yet. Now, we might talk a little bit here, though, about the probability. I know we've already on the show talked about the debt ceiling itself. And so we don't want to probably get into all of that. But we are certainly kind of getting to the end of May. We're getting to the beginning of when we could potentially not be able to pay those debts. And we're getting some increased polling data surrounding what people's feelings are on that. And that might be something to talk about. So, McCarthy has made it pretty plain. No debt ceiling increase without spending cuts. Now, Biden initially said he wanted a clean debt ceiling increase. But he has seemed willing to negotiate on that point to agree, although he has gotten pushback from progressives that are worried that he shouldn't be doing this. If you take a look at the most recent polling this week from both CNN and from Monmouth University, we see in this case, Republicans might be actually a little bit more in the lane. 60% of Americans say that the debt ceiling should be lifted only if it comes with specific spending cuts. That's a pretty big deal from my point of view. Maybe even more surprisingly is that 15% of Americans said that the debt ceiling simply should not be increased. That was a larger number than I would have anticipated. Only 24% said it should be lifted without spending cuts or anything else. Now, you might assume, and that's kind of what I oftentimes do in these big levels, is, okay, that's the overall, but how does it break out when you kind of take a look at that by ideological divide? And this is where I think, again, there was some surprises, because it doesn't look as pretty for Democrats on that front to be hardliners. And I think probably why Biden is willing to negotiate in part. So unsurprisingly, 79% of Republicans say that there has to be those spending cuts. 58% of independents said the same thing with spending cuts. But where you might think Dems would be the inverse, that's not the case. They were statistically tied. 46% of Democrats are for raising it no matter what. 45% of them for raising it only with spending cuts. Now, right now, according to Monmouth University, Biden and Republicans are being about equally blamed for the situation. But if people are honest in what they're saying in holding to the spending cuts, it doesn't seem like holding out for spending cuts is going to maybe be the most politically expedient motion for Biden. I mean, as we come into next week, what do you think starts to happen? I mean, I kind of think a deal is still a possibility, but maybe I'm wrong. What do you think about that?
Well, first on the polling, I think that it's almost entirely worthless, because I think if I don't know that they did, but I don't believe that they did. If Monmouth have asked a question of, can you explain what the debt ceiling is? the percentage of people actually could. So should that's, I mean, Dave, you phrase the question differently. If you say, do you think that the United States should decide unilaterally not to pay its bills and go into default, you'd get very different percentages. So I don't think that matters. It matters how the parties spin it. It matters what the real consequences are, just like people are all for spending cuts on programs that aren't theirs, but it's got to be someone's program who's cut. So I don't put much, I don't think the polling matters a whole lot, but I also don't think that we're going to have a default. It seems like they're pretty close to a deal, and maybe it happens Tuesday, maybe it happens Wednesday, but it looks fairly certain, I would say 80% plus likelihood, if I had to guess, that there's going to be a deal. And we already know kind of what the basic outlines. It seems like now they're just fighting on, well, what are the caps going to be? I mean, it seems like there's already kind of an agreement in principle on there won't be caps or the same caps on defense spending, on veteran spending. Then maybe you talk about, well, what will caps be on non-defense discretionary? How much of a haircut does the IRS increase in funding of $80 billion that supplemental appropriations take? It's certainly probably not nothing, but is it $10 billion? Is it $20 billion? What? But yeah, there'll be a deal. I'm fairly certain of that.
So what do you think in terms of, so we have the deal, do you think there's a particular winner or loser in that? Obviously, there are, one of the potential problems is if you have too many defections, is you might end up with a deal, but you have too many progressives and you have too many conservatives who say, like, look, we want more things. Does that kind of scenario worry?
I think the winners are the American people and the world, for the largest economy in the world deciding not to default on its debt, not to pay its bills. So, generally speaking, people win when governments do the responsible thing. So there's that. As to the politics of it, I think it can be spun either way. And I mean, talking about averting a disaster isn't particularly compelling politics. Because of what I did, I averted a disaster. Or because of what they did, there was almost a disaster. No, those aren't very good campaign talking points. So politically, I see this as a non-starter. And especially because any deal is looking to keep the debt ceiling, or to increase the debt ceiling, until after the 2024 election. So as a matter of policy, this is probably a good thing. It shows that you can always extract some leverage by using this as a sort of a hostage taking sort of thing. Republicans have known that for a long time, and they're using the leverage they have. So there you go.
So, I mean, one of the things that kind of gets thrown around all the time, which amuses me a little bit, is this idea of, well, we need, every year it's going to get a little bit closer and a little bit closer and a little bit closer, and one day we're going to end up tipping over. I think that's kind of the pessimistic view. There doesn't seem to be a lot of indication that's the case, though.
Yeah, it doesn't happen as long as everyone's a Republican. It's only when Republicans are control the chamber of Congress and the president's a Democrat. Republicans are happy to raise a debt ceiling on one of their own in the White House. It's just when the Democrat is at the White House where all of a sudden it's this horrible thing, right? So, it's all about political leverage.
Now, Democrats including Joe Biden, haven't wanted to increase the debt ceiling unless they got concessions in the past. As a matter of fact, Ken and I talked about that a number of weeks ago.
Really? So you're saying there have been times in recent memory where a Democratic-controlled chamber has refused to increase the debt ceiling when a Republican was president?
Oh, no.
Okay. I just want to be clear on that. I didn't think so. All right. So maybe it's just because that configuration didn't come about. But and also, I would say that this whole thing is kind of a fake argument. Maybe this is where you and I have a little more distance even than we would on this. But I don't think our debt I certainly think it's not nothing, obviously. But I don't think it's nearly the deal that all these big deal that all these chicken littles on the far right are screaming about. I know you're one of them, Trey, right? So why do you think the sky is falling exactly?
I'm careful about this. I think one of the problems that individuals on the right and libertarians have had has been Well, I remember even back like in the 80s when Ron Paul wasn't quite as nutty as he is today. But, you know, he was always talking about like, you know, any minute now, any moment now, you know, the currency is going to collapse. We got to think about gold. We got to think about gold. And I think part of his problem was, is it wasn't that there wasn't any underlying reality to the problems of large scale debt. But, you know, it's the problem of being realistic in the terms of what that kind of timeline looks like. And so I think where I try to come down on is I don't think that, okay, in a year, 5 years, you know, the economy blows up. But what I would argue, and this is where I do think we have some distance, is if we continue to have both parties when they control both chambers to continue to increase it at the rates that we do, there will be an inflection point. And maybe what you have to have is a good crisis to finally have everybody have a conversation about that. But I guess one of the things that it always confuses me about Democrats when it comes to this issue is to say, look, I can even get on board with the idea that we need to have the taxes to spend for what we're doing. But it always feels like that then comes along with additional spending that still isn't getting paid for on top of it. It's just not sustainable forever. So even if I say, like, you know, even if you kind of grant and say, look, I don't think we're going to go off a fiscal cliff this year, that still doesn't make your house in order when it comes to your goal. So it's like you're saying, well, I don't think we have a big enough debt yet. Okay, I mean, fair. But at the same time, I don't know. I wouldn't suggest that we continue to spend until we finally hit that limit. Wouldn't you want to have some wiggle room in there?
Sure. And you know, I'll pull back a little bit and say that I agree with you that it's not a problem. I mean, interest on the debt was something like just under $400 billion this year. And that's just under 7% of all federal spending. That's obviously a concern. And if you take a look at debt as a percentage of GDP over time, that's gone up. If you take a look at us compared to all the other OECD countries, of those 38 countries, I believe we have the fourth highest debt as a percentage of our enormous GDP. And so those are all very real, very concerning stats. But I will point out the other end. Well, borrowing costs for the government are still really low. I believe I looked it up earlier today, the average or the cost for a 10-year T-bill is 3.83%. That's under the long-term average of 4.25%. And so I guess this is a weird statement, Trey, but I might actually have more faith in markets on this than you do. Wow. I feel like you're right. There is a point, but I think the markets will let us know what that point is because if the U.S. gets into an unsustainable or increasingly unsustainable position, if you're an unworthy borrower, then in every circumstance that I can think of, right, it's basic economic theory, your borrowing costs go in because lenders factor that into the being willing to loan you that money. And we just haven't seen that really so much. And so that's why I'm not a modern monetary theory person. I'm not saying we can just print trillions of dollars and do whatever the hell we want. But I do think we're further away from the sky falling, and the sky's not going to fall. It's just going to gradually sort of close in on us to the point where we're like, oh, wow, it costs us so much to take on this much more debt. And we're going to see a gradual readjustment of this without having to do anything drastic, like decide we're not going to pay our bills one day.
Well, see, I think that's where I come step into that argument and say, well, look, I mean, yes, the market is definitely going to eventually penalize you for those kinds of items. But if you kind of take on the household analogy, do you really want your credit score tanking enough to be the reason that you decrease your household spending? Or, you know, in an ideal kind of policy world, wouldn't you want to think about that before the credit score is impacted, and you're not potentially in that kind of crisis mode where you still have cheap debt to potentially be able to have softer landings on those fronts? So, I mean, I hear you. I don't disagree that the market wouldn't respond to that. I'm just not sure if when you start to get penalized, if that's going to be the time that you really want to take it seriously in that sense.
I understand the analogy, but I think you could look at it another way. And the analogy then is, well, If you're a company, shouldn't we maybe lower prices before the market tells us so we can beat the market? I mean, it sounds like you're making can't just a bunch of smart people in Washington, D.C. do better than the market? I mean, if you want to make that argument, okay, but I don't know. And also, I would say that a lot depends on what you spend on. I mean, I, as you know, Trey, I am I'm a watch collector. I have a problem, even on my low end kind of professor salary. And it's one thing if I say if I borrowed $10,000 or $1,000 to buy watches, right? That would be a dumb investment. That would be depending. But anyway,
I was gonna say if you got the right Rolex, I'm not sure.
But if I borrow that to get some kind of credential to increase my ability to get a better job or something like that, that's a very different kind of spending. And so I think what we need to not just look at as, well, this is money that we're borrowing money. Well, to do to what? Not to set it on fire. We're borrowing money in many cases to make investments in our national defense, in our veterans, in healthcare for people, in security for people, in job training, and so many things. And so I think when we just look at this spending and borrowing, that really obscures the much more important question of, because if I can borrow at 2% and make an investment that ends up netting me 3% in the long run, I'd be fiscally irresponsible to not do that.
Now, I'm up for even having that kind of conversation about, you know, good debt versus bad debt, although we probably have some disagreements. You know, you were talking about investments in defense spending, and I'd probably disagree with that one. But that puts me in a weird position. I recognize that.
It does. Yeah.
I mean, and that's one of the areas when you take a look at this, the two big items that have to change at some point, and this is where I disagree with Republicans in this particular debate. Well, you know, we want to have spending cuts, but we don't want to have defense spending cuts. And the answer is, well, if you take a look at the budget, though, unless you're making fundamental changes to Social Security or defense, you're not making any kind of meaningful long-term changes.
Right. Yeah. And I agree on that. I think where we would differ is, I don't think we should be making meaningful defense spending cuts in the world that we're living in right now, whereas you're, I guess, more comfortable with that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that our, I mean, and this is what makes me a little bit different. I don't think that our spending on defense is what prevents Putin from doing, from, you know, invading or not invading or shooting at us or not shooting at us. But I know we disagree there, and we should probably move forward.
Yeah, I'm less concerned about Putin than I am about Xi, you know, and China and that sort of thing. But not that Putin is not a concern, but yeah, I think you're right. That is that puts you in a weird position, right? Regarding other conservatives, and maybe aligns me much more with mainstream conservatives than you on this particular policy point.
Oh, for sure. I mean, when you and Jay talk about this, it's always one where you guys have broad agreement, which I think sometimes confuses listeners. And then, you know, Ken and I end up having some broad agreement, which also confuses people. let's move forward to some Supreme Court rulings, because we had a couple of rulings that were worth taking a look at. The first one is Sackett versus the Environmental Protection Agency. And the Supreme Court changed the regulations as related to nations' wetlands and waterways. And it was a weird ruling in a sense, because the major issue in this case was what counts as, quote, waters of the United States, end quote, according to the Clean Water Act. Now, 20 years ago, the court ruled that wetlands are protected if they have a, quote, significant nexus, end quote, to regulated waters. Now, what's interesting is the court unanimously narrowed that scope. What was then up for question, and where there was a significant amount of debate, was how then should the Clean Water Act be interpreted? And on that front, the justices split 5-4. And again, not precisely as you might have imagined. The majority opinion on that portion of it was written by Alito, who embraced Scalia's opinion in the original case, arguing that waters of the United States only encompasses, quote, those relatively permanent, standing or continuously flowing bodies of water forming geographical features that are described in ordinary parlance as streams, oceans, rivers, and lakes, end quote. So what this means pragmatically is that wetlands need to be directly connected to those kinds of bodies to be protected. Now, Kavanaugh, though, wrote a concurring opinion, which really, if you take a look at it, in many ways is a dissent on this second question, i.e. what constitutes these being connected to these waterways. And what he argues is, quote, "I write separately because I respectfully disagree with the court's new test for assessing whether wetlands are covered by the Clean Water Act," end quote. Specifically, he thinks we need to have a bigger conversation according to adjacent and adjourning, and several liberal justices joined in with him as well. What did you think about all of this, Mike?
Well, I agree with Justice. I agree with all the court in the first case, the unanimous court, right? It's not on the fact that, yes, the Sacketts, their land should not have been regulate or was not liable to be regulated under the Clean Water Act, but everyone agrees on that. But on the interpretation issue, I agree with Justice Kavanaugh and the other dissenters in that you could have reached that decision by sticking with the precedent that has been in place, and not just in past Supreme Court decisions, but also if you take a look at amendments to the Clean Water Act, what seems to be the intent of Congress. But instead, what I would argue, what is a 5-justice conservative activist majority decided that they would write the law. And I remember back in the day when conservatives were all up in arms against legislating from the bench, but I guess it's okay if it's toward ends that you prefer as opposed to ends that you don't. And even Justice Kavanaugh recognized that by pointing out that, you know, when you do this, as he put it, this will leave some long regulated adjacent wetlands no longer covered by the act, and also have serious repercussions for water quality and flood control throughout the United States. And so, I mean, it's tough slogging to get through some of his stuff on the semantic differences between adjacent and adjoining. But I think it's important, and those little words have meaning. And in this case, 5 justices decided that they get to put their meaning in place of anyone else's. And this is why I have a problem with not the decision, but certainly the opinion.
So, you know, this is one of the things that Ken and I have frequently talked about. And following the court, you know, he had really worried repeatedly, and we had been looking forward to some of these, looking down the pike at some of these cases coming. I mean, looking forward to in the sense like, oh, here they come. Maybe a little bit, I don't know. but in these cases, you know, the justices are going to kind of be in lockstep. The conservative justices are going to be in lockstep on this. But in case after case, and it's weird, there hasn't been a consistent dissenter. You know, this is varied on the cases we've looked at. In this particular case in Sackett, you have Kavanaugh being the dissenter. But it doesn't feel like there's a lockstep conservative majority. And so one of the things I keep kind of pushing on him has been this question of, well, what, and you were kind of, I think, kind of hinting at it there, like saying, well, the court kind of has these outcomes they want. They're going to push it this way no matter what, even though that's not conservative. But conservatives on the court, at least, don't seem to be universally slicing up in a particular way where they're agreeing over and over again. What would you say to that kind of response?
Yeah, let me first make a distinction that probably wasn't clear in my initial remarks on this. I do not believe that the conservatives on the court are reasoning backward from their ideological preferences. I know, okay, Ken has argued that that is the case. When I was talking about conservatives being against legislating from the bench, I meant kind of conservatives broadly in the community.
I even misunderstood in that case.
But I think that there are at least almost always 5 justices on this court with a 6-justice conservative majority who are, in their view, in their understanding of regulation and government power, are anti-regulation enough, or pro-liberty or whatever, if you want, enough to provide majorities in cases like this, even if there's occasionally one justice who sees things differently from that conservative group, right? Like Kavanaugh did here. Mm-hmm. So I think this is entirely consistent with how the justices understand the Constitution, the laws, the role of the court. I disagree with that. And so my point is more with people in the conservative community who aren't on the court saying they're crying legislating from the bench, but it sure does feel to me like this Supreme Court has decided for no particularly good reason, right? Because they would have gotten the exact same outcome. They could have ruled narrowly. And here I'm talking about judicial restraint, which is not necessarily consistent with the conservative philosophy, though people oftentimes run those things together. This is an example of a unquestionably non-restrained activist decision, because if you can decide a case without having to expand the scope of power or change the law, and you don't do that, well, you have decided against restraint. And there was a time when many conservatives were arguing, presumably in good faith, and maybe it was, that judicial restraint was an important concept in and of itself, no matter who had the majority on the court. But I hear a lot less of that now that there's a six-justice conservative majority on the court. And I'll leave listeners to conclude what they want to from that.
I think there's two things going on. I might try to answer your question a little bit. I think on the one hand, you talk about in the past, the voices, and we were talking about this just a minute ago in terms of the Republican primary. What we consider to be a conservative or Republican today in the United States is vastly different than what a conservative even would have been, say, in the early 1990s. And so I think that is, and again, that's not just something that happens on a one-way street. I think oftentimes when you see arguments towards Democrats, you know, you have the whole, well, you know, who was the party that was for slavery? You know, it was the Democrats, right? You're like, well, I mean, yeah, a few hundred years ago. But I think it is, in an intellectual way, worth pointing out, you know, we're living in a Trump party. And I think the Trump version of conservatism is not, nor is it in any way, a bit of concerned with constraint in those fronts. I think the idea isn't winning. The idea being, you know, we for too long had gentlemanly constitutional ideas of rules that have held us back, and now we're gonna fight the way the other side does. And again, I'm not arguing that that's the right or even accurate, but sure. I think that's the position that's being. I think that explains part of it. I don't think your average Republican is the same average Republican who would have made those arguments. I think the other bit to it, and this is a bit, you know, this is me kind of pulling in from presidential power, and this is something I'm sure you would agree with. I mean, I think you'll agree with. But that is the sense of, you know, you're always concerned about presidential power when it's not your party, right? You know, and I think maybe even more so, we see that happen in terms of the justices because the Supreme Court isn't turning over every year. It's an even more slower burn than that. You get it for a longer period of time, and so now it's, well, you know, it was probably a little activist. But it's just counterbalancing all the activism of my predecessor in that sense. I think those two explain a lot of the difference in those responses. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. And I was being a little bit harsh on, I think, some people in that I feel like oftentimes people haven't had the opportunities that, say, I have or Jay has on the other side, right, to, or you have, to give these matters a lot of thought and really dig into the theory and have well-developed positions on matters of, constitutional interpretive principles, right? I mean, that's a luxury that most people don't have. And so I think then when they see outcomes they don't like and they hear about principles that suggest that maybe those outcomes shouldn't be the case, they kind of latch onto them without understanding them. And they never really become a part of who they are. They're just kind of convenient things to yes, oh yes, and this, right? So I think for a lot of people, it's not that they were acting in any way in bad faith. They heard arguments that seemed to support their policy beliefs, and they said, well, yes, this too, obviously. And now that this no longer does that, they've jettisoned it. But it would be, in a way, kind of unfair to accuse those people of bad faith, because I don't really think that they understood what the arguments are. And, you know, they might say that, well, even if I did, the pragmatic, practical result is far more important than your abstract ivory tower principle. I think they're wrong about that, but it's not an illegitimate viewpoint to have in the first place.
No, and it's true. And it is worth to be mindful that most of us in most circumstances aren't having highly formed opinions in the sense that we connect our abstract beliefs to those pragmatic outcomes as consistently as we would like to think that we do. But that's a, you know, that's a matter that we could explore for a while in political sociology.
And you know, also, I know we're running up against time here, but one other thing I wanted to point out on this case, Trey, is that there was also kind of a little rump conservative group, right? Justice, not a group, but a duo, Justice Thomas, who oftentimes has, you know, Justice Alito as the sort of partner in crime, if you will. I shouldn't use that term, should I? I can't believe that slipped out. Freudian slip. Sorry. Anyway, ignore that. But anyway, he was joined by Justice Gorsuch. Seriously, I did not mean to do that, guys. I'm not trying to like throw shade anyway. But they joined in an opinion where they go even further in limiting Congress's authority. The argument Thomas made, and this is so Clarence Thomas certainly, is that, hey, shouldn't we look at the whole, what regulating interstate commerce means? And come on, how is, even if we're talking about adjacent and adjoining, does it really matter if maybe, you know, this person dumps whatever, dredges up a waterway or dams it or something like that? Hey, that might not be something we want, but does Congress really have the right under its commerce power to do that? Well, I mean, there's, you know, 70, 80 years of precedent that says it does, but Clarence Thomas has not been one to let precedent stand in the way of what he believes to be fundamental constitutional principles.
No, and he's been waiting. I feel in some ways he's almost like a kid who's been set free. He's like, yes, it's time. We need to ask all the questions.
And you know, and I got to say, I mean, I've taken lately in a weird way to defending Clarence Thomas, right? Because I feel like he does. I disagree with him on so many things. And I think he's done so many boneheaded and arrogant things in his non-judicial life. But my gosh, I feel like the guy is just a model of integrity when it comes to sticking with his principles. Although integrity is an important value, certainly, but if someone sticks with their principles, they're the wrong principles. Well, that's not the kind of integrity you necessarily want, right? But this idea, I find this idea that Justice Thomas is just deciding things based on whims or power or privilege or whatever trip Harlan Crow gives him, I find that to be more unbelievable for Justice Thomas than I would for probably any other justice on the court. And I find it pretty unbelievable for any of them. So I just wanted to throw that in there. Maybe I'm trying to overcompensate for that horrible.
No, like I don't disagree. I mean, you know, way back when I was taking constitutional law with an unnamed professor, you know, Justice Thomas was writing the same kinds of ways in the dissent with Scalia as he is now. He just has some compatriots who are closer to him, although yeah, still not willing to go all the ways that he wants to go. And so I think we just get to see a little bit more of it. So I don't disagree with that. You know, I can't tell you how often I've looked at the things you've written and you think, okay, in the dissent, I think we need to examine, you know, we need to re-examine how these powers work in terms of interstate commerce. And now I have a chance and I'm in the majority. I'm going to bring it up again. I don't disagree. I don't think you're overcompensating there.
And in the end, it, you know, probably in the balance, since he at best usually gets one or two people to join with him on some of these more sort of out there views, in the balance, it probably actually helps Democrats, helps the left, because we can point to that and say, oh my God, Clarence Thomas wants to tear up the Constitution or whatever, you know, and so we get some mileage out of it, you know, and hey, it's all good. Clarence gets to let his freak flag fly. And hey,
you know, having briefly met Clarence Thomas, I would love to have gotten to see you ask him about a freak flag. That just that would have been fun. Okay, so I know we're running short. We did want to just briefly mention kind of the Russian insurrection and Ukraine's push. And, you know, we are in day 457 of the war. And today, as a matter of fact, or last night, depending on how you're looking at this, Russians launched missile strikes on a medical clinic in eastern Ukraine, killing 2 and injuring 23. Zelensky called it yet another war crime, but it seemingly is kind of a nasty, brutal, evil response to what happened on Monday when in Russia proper, two Ukraine-based Russian opposition militias claim the start of an attack to, quote, liberate Russia. Ukraine has denied any involvement in the raid, but it does show some of the potential weakness on the Russian border on the eve of a potential Ukrainian offensive. And today they have announced, that is, the militias have announced, that more attacks are coming and will take place inside of Russia. All of this sitting, of course, on the backdrop of F-16s and training coming to Ukraine. So, Mike, any broad thoughts about this week, the war actually taking place in Russia?
Well, you know, good for them, right? Anything that can get the Russian people to sort of feel the costs of this disastrous war that their dictator has led them into under false pretenses, I'm all for that. Anything that could maybe, I mean, support in Russia for the war, as best we can tell. Obviously, polling is difficult for reasons I think should be clear to anyone. You know, I end up falling out a window or something like that, what have you. But support is still pretty
strong. Might be more straightforward than that. Just a gun.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just honest.
No, not at all. I mean, support seems to be, you know, strong still, but I think in recent months there have been some indications that it's weakening a little bit because, I mean, was it in Bakhmut that it looked like Russia had killed and wounded maybe more than 100,000 total? It's a huge number. And eventually, when enough kids aren't coming home to their families, that starts to build even in a repressive authoritarian regime. And so, you know, that's tragic. I feel so much for those families who this horrifically evil human being, Vladimir Putin, has destroyed their lives for his sick ambitions. But if this helps to bring it to a close closer and more, we can, you know, innocent lives can be saved. Well, that's great. Although, honestly, I don't see much hope of that in the long term, because I mean the F-16 thing, that's going to be months for that has much of a difference, right? As General Miley told reporters this week, I mean the Russians have more than something like 1,000 fourth generation fighters, and so this is, you know, it's symbolic. We thought we were going to get there, but it sure looks like this is going to be a long slog with a lot more people who should be living long and full lives being killed because of this horrible human being.
No, it's difficult to understand. The distance that we have from war, I think, makes it difficult for us sometimes to understand the truly horrific nature of these kinds of deaths. But yeah, well, yeah, you know, on those positive notes, I don't know what it is, Mike. When we do the show together, I always feel like we end up on a really positive.
I just got to say, I mean, I remember, you know, I had some, you know, firsthand experience with war. Thankfully, you know, not anything really like serious, feeling like my life was in imminent danger, bullets whizzing all around me kind of thing, though I'm sure I could make up some plausible stories based on what I know. That's what you do. But I recall, you know, on some of the bombing runs, and you wouldn't even see them. You would just feel the impact, this low bass rumble that was just everywhere. And I just thought to myself, oh my God, those poor people, those poor bastards who are just, you know, it's not none of their fault, and they're just being obliterated, and it's just horrific. It really is. If you've had any kind of exposure to war, it's an awful thing, even when it's good. And it just turns my stomach when I think about how many people have been hurt and killed in this, and how many families affected, and how much longer it looks like it's still going to have to go on before there's any kind of resolution. I'm slow to call anyone evil, to use that term, but if it applies to anyone in the modern world, it applies to Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the other positive thing to be said about here, I remember us talking about this a little over a year ago, because we actually did the three host. It was you, myself, and Jay at the outset, trying to look forward. And, you know, and here that we are, Ukraine is still in existence. And that's not nothing.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's a testament to the support and the courage and all of that of the Ukrainians especially, but also the Western Alliance behind them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably where I have to leave it, Mike. That's going to be the end of this show. And so what I'm going to say to everybody who's listening, if you're not already a supporter of the Politics Guys, I hope you'll consider to become one. Without our supporters, you know, that's what keeps the podcast going. And when you become a supporter, you get all sorts of really good stuff, like an ad-free version of everything we put out, our exclusive midweek show. But more importantly, you're going to have an opportunity if you're at the $10 or more level, on June 3rd at 9 a.m. Eastern, to join Mike and Jay for our first ever live interactive show with questions. And so again, you know, this might be the week you've been thinking about it. You know, do I want to be a supporter of the Politics Guys? Well, June 3rd, 9 a.m. Eastern, if you become that supporter before then, you're going to have the possibility to be a part of that show. That would be, I think, really cool to be a part of that inaugural show. So that means becoming a supporter of the Politics Guys. So how do you do that? If you want to become a supporter of the Politics Guys, you can head to patreon.com/politicsguys. You can also support us on Venmo, where we're at Politics Guys. You can support the show through PayPal, and there's some other ways. And all of those are in our support links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. So just head on down to the show notes and click on your favorite way to link in and support the show. And again, if you do that at the $10 level or more, you're going to be able to be part of that live show on June 3rd. Now, if you just like to get that midweek show that we have, one of the opportunities for those of you who are a supporter, but you're just not in a position to financially do that, well, that's what Mike is here for. You can actually reach out to him at mike@politicsguys.com, and he can set you up. And again, as the dad of three, I can tell you that I know how that is. So whether you're a supporter or not, though, we would really appreciate it if you would subscribe to this on the podcast app of your choice. It just takes a minute to hit that button. I know they pop up all the time. I get tired of it. But it is a huge deal for podcasts. And if you could just go that extra step and maybe write just a sentence and review us on that podcast app of your choice, that's huge too. Other people taking a look at that comment and going, hey, is this worth my time? Is this hour worth my time? That's a huge deal for us. And of course, you could share this episode or others on social media. If you've got a question, comment, correction, gripe, manifesto, or anything else you'd like to share, you can always reach us at mail@politicsguys.com. We're also on Facebook and on Twitter, and you'll find the links to all of that in the show notes. The executive producers of The Politics Guys are Bruce Johnson, Wilma Marino, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, Don Oglesby, and Ivan English. We'll be back with a new episode. Hope you'll join us then.